Today, a 1930s rerun. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. It's my Friday afternoon chat with Tarek Brooker. And boy, Tarek, there's a lot going on.
Oh, there is, isn't there? Where do you start? You know, you've got markets plummeting and then bouncing like almost never seen before. You know, it's something that's only been recorded a couple of days in recent history. And then you've got everything going on in the Ukraine. And, you know, I mean, you just got to be glued to the social media feed to see what's going on.
Well, I must congratulate you because you picked the time of the invasion pretty much down to the day.
Well, like I said on Twitter, you know, I'm not an expert, but I listen to those who are. And, you know, there was all this hyperbole about the American saying it's going to come on this day, it's going to come on this day. And it all just gave Putin a little bit of a boy who cried wolf moment. And then when he finally did it, everyone was like, he's actually done it. I thought this whole thing was a bit of a joke. But Putin wasn't really going to tread on the Chinese's toes by, you know, raining on their parade during their moment in the sun during the Winter Olympics. And, you know, less than 48 hours after, it was pretty clear that he was going to go to town. So, you know, it's unfortunate, but, you know, that's the thing with global politics. It's got a life of its own.
And I think it's very interesting that he recorded his final speech, effectively the invasion speech, right, according to the recent analysis. In other words, he actually had it in the can ready to go.
Yeah, I quite like how they figured that out with all the different people's watches saying the wrong time for something that you know, could have been a live speech or something that he's recorded, you know, relatively close to time. But, I mean, I think it's pretty clear at this point that this is a fairly premeditated attack. This isn't something that he's just come up with relatively recently. You look at the scale of the thing, it's, you know, absolutely enormous. You know, I've got some slides later in the show that just illustrate the absolute enormous scale of this thing. And I think it's also just important to keep in mind that Ukraine is an absolutely enormous country. It's if you discount Russia, it's the biggest country in Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a broader canvas here as well, right? Because if Ukraine and Russia, you know, has a relationship, Taiwan and China have a somewhat equal relationship. So I just wonder whether we'll see China taking the opportunity to just nip over there and do something similar.
I don't think at this point we will see that. I think that China is very much going to be in a wait and see mode over the next few months to see exactly what the West does, to look for signs of weakness, to look for signs of division and basically the West not carrying through on their threats. You know, they've made some pretty big threats. They've talked about basically banning Russia from trading in dollars and British pounds. And when I say dollars, I mean US dollars. And obviously that would be huge. But then on the other hand, you've got all these other countries that have trade interests with Russia, say the Italians with the luxury goods industry, or the Germans who are reliant on Russian gas, or the Belgians who are reliant on Russian diamonds. And they're all not too happy about their chosen industries being impacted by sanctions. So it's those sorts of weaknesses that China will be looking for that sort of division. And obviously, I think it's also just important to keep in mind that the Japanese have pledged to defend Taiwan. They have, you know, very publicly made that clear. You know, they've made that clear in their defense white paper. They've made that clear with various statements by their foreign ministers. And the Japanese have, you know, probably the third most powerful navy in the world, you know, depending on how you do it, whether it's on ship numbers or tonnage. And the Americans will back the Japanese. But the thing with geopolitics is it's about perceptions. It's not about, you know, an objective reality, if an objective reality does exist. So I think it's going to be interesting in that regard, because obviously China is going to be looking for that weakness. And whether the weakness is real or not, you know, it doesn't really matter as long as they think it is.
Yes, a lot of it actually, as you say, perception rather than reality. I do think the SWIFT conversation is quite an interesting one, you know, that international payment system, right, which would actually be quite a significant event if they turned it off, because a lot of international transactions are actually settled through the SWIFT system. But as you say, a lot of those European countries are very, very resistant to that for obvious reasons, right? It would actually cut their own nose off despite their face. So there's a lot to play, here. And the more I look at it, the more I think it's sounding horribly soggy and a bit like the 1930s all over again, right? Which is probably where your slide should come in.
Yes, well, just before we get to that, I think, you know, we should just point out that that's something that you and I have been discussing since the start, since around about this time in 2020, you know, that basically that the pandemic and the economic after effects would create those sorts of problems in the long run. And here we are. I mean, to be honest, not even I was expecting this level of attack and this level of, you know, upheaval, really, but here we are. Just a quick qualifier, I was expecting it, just not this soon.
Exactly. Well, timing, of course, is always the tough thing to call. But in terms of those international dynamics, you know, there were signals some time back that things were actually going to play out a bit like this. And you can actually go back 8 or 9 years to the last time that Russia sort of started nibbling around the edges, and you could see some of the, you know, the things being left. And the other point, of course, is that the point you make, and I'm sure you'll make it in the slides, this was a carefully calculated positioning from Russia, right? This wasn't something sort of cooked up in 5 minutes. This has been going on for a long, 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 long time. And it's like we always knew it was going to come to a board at some point, and bingo, now it's here.
Yep, well, that's as good a point as any to get to the slides.
Okay, there you go.
All right, well, you know, I think that picture pretty much sums it up. You know, you got... And, you know, these two are going to play their role in deciding the future of the world. Okay, now, this, before I get too far into it, on the left, we have Russia's exports as a share of total global production. And on the right, we have Russia's share of total global production. So just so those two don't get confused, they are different things. But it shows that Russia is an absolutely key supplier of raw materials, of gas, of energy, of fertilizer, of all manner of different things. And that is something that I think that the market and people just more broadly are not fully appreciating. Now, it's entirely possible that the West is going to, shall we say, be less than as forceful as promised with sanctions, and that may sort of put some, you know, that may allay some of the upward pressure on these various commodities. But the thing is, if things do escalate, if the West does decide to impose these sanctions and it does turn into a, and I quote Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, a economic tit for tat, then, you know, you could see the price of these things going through the roof. I mean, the JP Morgan came out the other day and they said that if Russian supplies of oil were interrupted, we could see the price of oil go up to $150 a barrel. In some places, we've already seen the cost of fertilizer and fertilizer components go up 25%. So it's going to be a very challenging time if the West does call, you know, Vladimir Putin's, you know, aggressive actions for what they are, and they do act as they promised.
And one point, of course, to make is the gas there, 6.2, that, of course, is global. But if, of course, a lot of it's going into particular European markets, right? And, you know, if you look at some of them, and you may have a slide later, I don't know. But, you know, some of those European countries are really, really reliant on Russian gas.
There are, especially some of the countries in the former Yugoslavia. Say, for example, Estonia is almost 100% reliant on Russian gas. So... It just goes to show that Europe really has a problem in that regard. And, you know, it's not as simple as just flipping a switch and going, that's okay, we're just going to import American or Australian or Qatari LNG. It is different. Infrastructure needs to change. Things need to be done differently. And it's not just as simple as, you know, and then everything's fine. So I think that there's a major disconnect in that regard between what the market perceives as the hit from this, if the West does choose to go after the Russians with all these sanctions they've discussed, like SWIFT, or, you know, they actually do stop the Russians trading in dollars. I mean, yes, that's going to be, you know, for China, they're just going to go, okay, well, we're going to buy the oil, we're going to buy the gas to a degree. But then what happens to this, to people who are relying on Russian gas? It's not that simple. Or even just the basic stuff like fertilizer, there's only so much of it in the world. You know, there's only so much production, and the price of gas is already through the roof, which is a major component in a lot of nitrate based fertilizers.
And just to give you a bit of a perspective, you know, if you tried to replace the pipeline of gas coming from Russia into Europe with LNG ships, right, you'd pretty much have to have fleets and fleets and fleets of those ships depositing gas in Europe all the time. It's just physically not possible.
Well, the thing is, even if you were to somehow get all these ships run gas from Qatar, Australia, the US, the big exporters, straight into Europe constantly, you know, big convoys of these ships, what happens to the people in other nations who are reliant on LNG? You know, to the Japanese, to the Koreans, to the Chinese, you know, who are reliant on these LNG imports. So it's not as simple as, you know, just like I said, once again, just flipping that switch. Yep. There are huge ramifications. And, you know, that's something that we could see play out if the tit for tat escalates. And, well, if it doesn't, then, you know, there could be a whole other host of problems.
And, of course, if you look back in history, wars tend to be inflationary.
They do. They do indeed. And that's something as well. I mean, with all of this and with Russia and everything, Biden and the Europeans now have a scapegoat for inflation. They can blame Vladimir Putin. We were already seeing that narrative starting to take root in the US media. It's wrong. You know, yes, obviously this is going to contribute significantly to that, particularly if they do impose those high degree of sanctions. But the inflationary pressures were already baked in. But, you know, politics, well, narratives.
Central banks have an alibi, don't they? They could keep interest rates lower for longer now and say, well, we need to do that because, of course, we've got this war.
Well, I don't think they're going to be able to do that personally. I think that they're trapped. I mean, I think they're going to want to in some ways, but I think that by the same token, this risks a sort of Yom Kippur 1970s type situation whereby if they leave it too long, even if the cause is external, you end up with that inflationary feedback loop in wages. And that's something that they're really concerned about.
Absolutely right. And I've read a few people today who were saying, actually, you know, this Russian thing's really critically important, but it doesn't fundamentally solve the inflation problem. In fact, it probably makes it more significant, which means that, if anything, interest rates might have to go higher quicker rather than slower. So I agree with you. Central banks are up against the wall.
Well, at least if Governor Lowe at the RBA has to raise interest rates, he can blame Vladimir Putin. You know, that's why I had to raise them before 2024. It's all Putin's fault.
Ah, he's now got a perfect alibi. Great.
Yeah. Well, in a way, it does make the narrative a lot easier. It does make it a lot more politically sellable to the public, even though they're going to be the ones who have to suffer it at both ends.
Yeah, well, just don't mention the low wage price data that came out this week compared with what they said it was going to happen. But that's another story.
Yep, and we'll get to that later in the slides.
Okay.
Okay, this is from the Wall Street Journal this morning, basically showing that the strikes on Ukraine by the Russians have been very, very widespread. We've seen cruise missile strikes all the way to the Polish border and to the border with Moldova, and also the ground invasion has also been quite widespread, considering the fact that this is only about 36 hours old at this point, if that actually. And you know, they're still pushing. The fighting continues. The Russians recently took the power plant at Chernobyl, for all that's worth. if just for anyone who's wondering why they would want a radioactive wasteland, it's because it's the quickest and most rapid route from the Belarus border to Kiev.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's not because of the radioactive remnants or anything like that. It's just access, isn't it? And, of course, the fact that that area is highly unpopulated for obvious reasons and therefore is relatively easy to control.
Indeed. So, I mean, I guess we're just going to have to see exactly how all this plays out. The Russians have crossed the river in the south, and I would imagine are probably going to push for Odessa, which has a rather large ethnic Russian population. And I imagine they're also going to push for the areas of eastern Ukraine that have the infrastructure, that have the arms factories. Say for example, Zaporizhia, and I am so sorry to the Russian and Ukrainian people for absolutely butchering the name of one of your cities, but just in the middle of the map there on the river, starts with Z. That is the site of a very large helicopter and aircraft engine factory. That has been one of the thorns in the side of the Russians since Ukraine broke out of their sphere of influence in 2014. About 80% of the engines for Russian helicopters have come from factories with where the company is headquartered there, and that is where the lion's share of the production facilities are. So, there are those strategic targets that the Russians are going to push for. Even say, for example, Antonov Airport, which is northwest of Kiev, but which they tried to take and the Ukrainians have apparently taken back, is also the site of key aeronautical infrastructure. So it's going to be interesting because you don't know when the world is going to stop. I guess it just depends on what Putin's objectives are and how strong a fight the Ukrainians put up.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to learn a lot more about the geography of Eastern Europe than we probably ever want to know.
Yes, I think we will probably get quite an education on the pronunciation of various city and suburb names at this rate.
I'm still sort of reeling on the fact the old Chicken Kiev is now Chicken Kiev.
I noticed that one too. Okay, now m my apologies if this is a bit, shall we say, small in terms of the chart. The problem is that we are literally looking at a chart that does monthly updates to German producer price index, the German producer price index, going all the way back to 1949. And this shows that even during the very, very big producer price spike that occurred at the outbreak of the Korean War, things are worse now. And I can only imagine that once these energy price issues feed through to German industry as a result of the current issues in Ukraine, I mean, even if they are relatively limited in scope, it's still enough to probably send this for another record run next month. So, there's some fairly major pressures within German industry in terms of costs.
And producer prices, of course, are very important because they're input costs into everything else, right? So that's the first point in the process where you see spikes and then it flows through into the retail chains later.
Indeed. I mean, naturally, I should probably, point out that not all of this is going to flow through. Some of it is going to be, and I hate to use the word, but transitory. Some prices will return to, lower levels, as well, hopefully things eventually de-escalate and, we see some semblance of a return to normality. But it's also the fact that companies can absorb the rising cost into their own margins, but some of this is going to make it to German consumers.
And the most recent numbers weren't very positive, so it's already higher and inflation flowing through more quickly than people expected. So I think we're going to see more of it.
Indeed. Now, this is a good one. It's of US retail sales in inflation-adjusted terms. Now it shows that they peaked in April of 2021, largely as a result, I imagine, of the Biden administration's $1.9 trillion stimulus package, and they've since been in a bit of a downtrend. However, we did see quite a nice uptick in the last data for January, and that's something that's a bit interesting, and I will get to that in the next slide as to why that's interesting. Consumer credit is exploding. There is data going all the way back to 1943 and we have seen the largest expansion of US consumer credit month on month in history by a rather large amount in recent months. And it just goes to show that this is increasingly credit driven. And, you know, I don't think we need to inform the audience that that's not really all that sustainable.
Well, we've been doing that for quite a little while. And I've noticed, actually, by the way, in Australia, the consumer credit numbers are starting to rise now. Suddenly the credit cards are being used. That's because people are out of stimulus, basically.
Yep. And I just think that that's what's going to be really interesting, particularly now in the US as these programs finally come to an end, because, you know, things like the child tax credit, the student loan repayment holiday, those two programs are worth roughly as much as Obama's entire GFC stimulus package. And over the coming months, they are going to be pulled out of the US economy, all at a time when consumers are increasingly concerned about inflation and arguably, you know, set to potentially tighten their belts, particularly if petrol prices continue to rise as a result of geopolitical conflict.
And don't mention the interest rates.
Well, that's a thing that, well, thankfully for Americans, about 90% of them have fixed rate mortgages. That's about 63, you know, that's household debt that's worth about 63% of, no, sorry, not 63% of GDP. Yeah, US household debt, I believe is around about mortgage, it's about 70% of GDP. And so, you know, most of that is going to be fine, but other consumer credit is obviously going to be, you know, household credit is going to be exposed to that. So it's going to be quite interesting to watch. And well, obviously here in Australia, we're going to get hit the hardest because we have variable rate loans. And yeah, while in recent years, fixed rate loans have taken on a larger share of loans being issued and loans being refinanced, there are still a lot of people on variable rate loans, particularly now that the banks are lower, have, well, what would you call them, bait rates, you know?
Well, they're not mates rates, I'll tell you.
Well, you know, promotional rates, yeah, you know, variable absolutely. Rates at very, correct. Very low rates.
Very low rates to pull you in, but then, of course, they can just put them up later and you've got nowhere to go. And it's interesting, Westpac came out this last week and said, you know, fixed rates, and there's about probably a quarter of loans on fixed rates at the moment. Next time they actually reset those rates, they'll be 1 to 2% higher than they currently are. So there's already a tsunami coming of higher rates just because of where the markets currently are, let alone what happens with the variable rates when they start moving up, as they will.
What was the estimate from CBA? I think it might have been CBA the other day who did an estimate, and they said in the next, what was it, 18 months or 2 years, is it got to be about $500 billion worth of fixed rate loans refinanced? Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, that's about right. No, and that would be close to what I would expect as well. If you think of it, it's roughly a quarter of all people are on fixed. And of course, some of them have been on 5 years, but a lot of them are on 1 and 2 and 3 year rates. So yeah, that would make a lot of sense. That's a big number. And what I find interesting when I talk to my people through the one-to-one conversations is they felt quite good about those fixed rates when they went into them because rates were so low and it seemed great. But now there's the realization of this looming problem ahead. And they know that those rates are going to be higher. So they don't just do nothing, right? So basically they spend a bit less now to try and position themselves for what happens. Because, of course, what they can't do on a fixed rate loan is forward pay it. You know, on a variable rate, you can actually make additional contributions to basically drop the amount that you owe. You can't really do that with a fixed rate because it's all part of the contractual structure about the fixed rate loan. So the only thing you can do is to start hunkering down now and start saving somewhere else so that you've got a bit of leeway when those higher rates come in. And people are already starting to do that. So that will hit confidence.
Indeed it will. This is an interesting one that I quite like. It basically shows that about a third of America's Russell 2000 stock index, which is their sort of smaller companies that don't make it to the S&P 500, you know, et cetera, mostly, you know, in industry, you know, industrial type businesses, that roughly a third are expected to be unprofitable. And that's really something when you think about it. You know, this isn't spiking now because of a recession. We've seen enormous amounts of stimulus flow through, yet it's still not enough. It's not enough to get us back to even, you know, 2015 or even, or frankly, even 2020 levels. So, you know, before the pandemic. So, you know, there's some fairly major headwinds ahead in that regard. And part of the thing as well with that is, as these companies, who some of whom don't have investment grade credit ratings, as they come to refinance, and as rates rise, it's going to potentially present some challenges. And also, just, you know, I mean, that's normally how the cycle functions. And then, you know, they'll consider trimming their costs, which then also feeds into consumer confidence and unemployment.
Absolutely. And a lot of those corporates, of course, issued a lot of debt and bought back their shares earlier on to sort of artificially inflate their share price, right? So it wasn't actually the business performance that actually was good. It was actually the financial engineering around it, right? But that can no longer work when rates start to go up and the cost of debt start to go up. And we're already seeing B and C grade debt costs rising significantly even now in the US. So I'm afraid that the party's over.
People talk about, you know, the price to earnings ratio, the P and E. The problem is the problem, as I see it, isn't just the price, isn't just the fact that, you know, we're seeing very, very high multiples relative to history. It's also the earnings side of things. How is the earnings side of things going to fare when inflation starts to bite margins? Yep. And also, how is it going to fare as this stimulus is finally withdrawn from the economy? And eventually, when consumer credit starts to, you know, sort of go off the boil, and it reaches a, you know, something of a peak, you know, maybe that's 6, 12, 18 months away, but that is another headwind that's going to be faced once people who are facing these inflationary pressures are finally just tapped out and they can't hold on just by going further into debt anymore.
It'll be very interesting to see when the R word really starts coming up in the public discourse. It's hardly there at the moment, but there are a few people talking about, you know, US recession in the next 12 to 18 months.
Well, I think that's a reasonable call. I mean, it depends a lot on what happens with the market, what happens with the course of the Fed, et cetera, because, you know, we've got an election coming up in November in the US, which is, you know, going to be hugely important. And I mean, to be completely frank, I don't think that the Fed, as long as it was relatively contained to stocks, I don't think the Fed would really care that much if the market really crashed. If it, you know, talking 30, 35% down from its peaks, you know, that's going to take a lot of heat out of the economy. It's going to take a lot of heat out of the broader market and all these things that are, you know, this sort of wealth effect that's been driven by, runaway asset prices. And also the fact that you're going to see the housing market start to cool if that confidence is hit as well. And I mean, it'd be challenging to be able to engineer a market crash that doesn't ensure a recession. But by the same token, you could also see towards the tail end of that potential period, the checkbook just get, you know, opened up like we haven't seen since 2020, and then woof. You know, money thrown into the economy, it's okay, inflation's over for now, the market crash is taking care of that. And I mean, it's a scenario that I think is possible, especially now that they can blame it on Putin and just be like, oh no, Putin crashed the market, and then we've, you know, rode in on our white horse with our checkbook, you know, open for all the good girls and boys.
Absolutely. Well, that would suggest then that whilst rates might be going up in the short term, they'll probably have to come down again, right? Because that would be the natural corollary of that. And of course, normally when rates get cut to try and, you know, restart the economy again, they have to go lower than where they were previously, which suggests they could go negative.
Yeah, well, in Australia, that is well and truly, you know, within the realm of possibility, especially if, you know, low gets caught behind the curve, which, you know, I mean, if you look at New Zealand, you look at the Bank of, you know, your Bank of England, he arguably already is, and I mean. Actually, I have something else to add, but I'll add it with the relevant slide. Okay. Now, this one shows US margin debt. And margin debt can be, at times, an indicator of basically the market, of how, with all this cash flowing in, it can be a strong driver of rising stock prices. And now it's falling. And I should also point out that this predates the various issues with Russia escalating and stuff like that. This chart is from before that. So, you know, if if we do start to see people trim their bets, especially people who've still, you know, well and truly in the black, you know, taking profits, you know, things could start to get really interesting, because, you know, margin debt, and not only that, but and retail investors have been a huge driver of the run up in the market since March 2020.
In fact, the Fed, in their last financial stability report, specifically mentioned the rise of margin debt and margin lending, specifically for relatively inexperienced new share, buyers. Right, so people have come into the market for the first time. Maybe they got a bit of money from the government, and then they've leveraged it up. And they were talking specifically about the financial stability risk that actually represented.
Yeah, and exactly. And there's the risk there that, you know, retail once again, you know, gets caught holding the bag, because, you know, the Fed and their lack of, you know, sort of commentary as to how would you put it? Just their lack of a narrative in terms of we're going to step away from the market at some point and we're going to let normal conditions resume, rather than allowing people to believe that the Fed is backing them and buying the dip. You know, like the other day I saw this video of this very, very upset young woman about losing her life savings in crypto, and she was saying some very, shall we say, not nice things about Matt Damon and some of the other people who had promoted it. And I can only imagine that if we do see US stocks fall, and fall 2020 style or 2008 style, a lot of people are going to be very, very angry with the Federal Reserve and with Jerome Powell, because they have allowed this narrative to persist, and they never should have let that happen. They should have been very clear about the market is the market. It's a free market. There are winners, there are losers, but we are not going to make winners and losers. Yet, you know, we're going to make people whole and all that other narrative. And, you know, people have just taken that and run with it over the last almost 2 years now.
Well, I've been preaching against this for quite some time, as you know, specifically for the reason that people have come into this, seen the markets rise, and then, you know, they just want to sort of pile in and just take the upside. But the point you make is dead right. For every trade, there's a winner and there's a loser. And unfortunately, if you're on the losing side of the trade, you ain't got nothing. So that's really important to understand. And the Fed and the other central banks have done, you know, a lot to try and keep the markets up. And, you know, the markets say, well, of course, the Fed will always rescue us. So the old Fed put. But what happens if they don't come to the party? Then, of course, it gets really interesting.
Indeed. And that's a point that Jim Bianco, the analyst, has made, you know, beautifully in a recent video. And he basically said that the Fed has, you know, there's two very different perspectives on the Fed. As far as, you know, the equity market is concerned, the concern is the market. It's about supporting the market. It's about making sure that the market and the market's going on doesn't hit growth, doesn't hit the economy, that it doesn't hit confidence. But the issue is, the Fed's mandate isn't the market. The Fed's mandate is inflation. And if they go back to targeting inflation, and that is their number one goal, then the market's in for a very unfortunate wake-up call. Yeah. You know, that is definitive. That isn't like, you know, opinion. That is just the way things are. It's just a very, very, very different opinion of different market participants. You know, like, say, the bond market, as far as the bond market's concerned, the Fed has to act. And it better act, otherwise the bond market is going to start doing the Fed's job for it. While as the, you know, a lot of folks on the equity side of things are still bullish and think that, you know, that it doesn't matter, that eventually if the market falls, you know, even, you know, not too much more, the Fed will step in.
And it goes back to, well, what is fair value? Fair value is not a single number in all situations, right? And fair value with Fed support is not the same as fair value without Fed support.
No, exactly. I mean, you know, some people, like the Bank of America, did a poll of people who use their services recently, you know, as in like institutionally use their services, like analysts, etc. And they concluded that the Fed put, aka the point where the Fed will step in, is it, you know, the consensus was around about 3700 on the S&P 500. But the truth is that the case? you know, the Fed has spent all this time, all this effort, all these resources trying to fix repo, trying to fix the treasury market, you know, trying to fix all of these plumbing issues, trying to fix even the junk bond market. I mean, and one of the interesting things with the junk bond market is this: if you actually break the junk bond market down into its different components, and I'm talking about the US junk bond market, because frankly, that's what the Fed cares about. If you break it down into its components of energy-related companies and non-energy-related companies, it's two very different pictures. For energy-related companies, during the pandemic-driven crash in 2020, their yields went to the moon. You know, I believe that the average yield on their debt was up to about 20% in junk bond territory, whereas normal companies was less than half that, a lot less than half that. But this time, oil prices are high. Oil prices are arguably structurally high. I mean, I'm not saying that there might not be a whole heap of downside if there is a recession. Sure, absolutely. But there is now those structural imbalances between supply and demand within the oil market, which is going to heavily support the strength of the US bond market, of these energy providers, of these energy service providers. So that's something that could really change the calculus for the Fed, because all of a sudden the high yield bond market looks a whole lot better on paper than it otherwise would. So, you know, I think that's an interesting factor that hasn't really been factored in by some market participants.
Well, there are so many factors that market participants really haven't quite woken up to yet. You know, wherever you look, they're under every stone. So I'm afraid that I keep talking about significant volatility, significant uncertainty, and that's one of the reasons why I still believe that you shouldn't be buying the dip, because I don't know where the bottom of the dip is, but I suspect the dip's lower than where it is now.
Well, that may well be the case, but I mean, I think we may end up finding out one way or another pretty soon. Now, I quite like this one, because basically it just shows the liquidity, you know, or breadth of the S&P 500 against the index itself. And it shows that basically things, the breadth of the market, the actual, you know, liquidity of the market is significantly lower now than even the dark days of February and March 2020. And it's that lack of liquidity within the market that could potentially lead, well, it doesn't potentially lead, we've seen in the last few days, does lead to these huge, big swings in sentiment and in price.
Yeah, and just talking about market depth, it's important to understand what we're talking about here. It's basically how much of the market is there that people want to buy, sell, or transact, right? So in a buoyant market, you have a lot of people looking to buy, a lot of people looking to sell, and therefore the market price-making mechanisms work quite well. But if you have relatively thin market depth, then essentially you have much more movements up and down because people struggle to try and actually get those trades. And low volatility, low market depth, actually is a sign of a very, very unstable and uncertain market. And that's what we've got at the moment.
Yep, it's yet another concerning indicator for stocks more broadly. And, you know, well, let's be honest, there are quite a few of them at the moment.
Yes.
Okay, as promised, the Aussie wage growth stuff. On the left, we have the number of workers reporting a pay rise. Less than a third of Australians are reporting a pay rise. So it's all well and good for the RBA and for, you know, some economists and commentators to say, oh, but wage growth has picked up. Yes, it has, for the less than 30% of people who are actually receiving a pay rise. Some people are doing very, very well. I've heard that some people are receiving 10, 15, even 20% pay rises in jobs and in-demand industries, particularly ones that have in the past relied on foreign labor and on, you know, people coming in on visas. But in broad terms, it's not that great. And I think that's what makes the inflation-adjusted wage growth chart that I've got there on the right all the more fascinating. Because even for the people who are receiving, you know, on average across the board, the average household, you know, assuming that they enjoyed the average pay rise, which they didn't, but let's say, you know, just for the sake of argument, they did, they're still going backwards to the tune of 1.2% per year. If you look at the almost the more than, according to the data from the Melbourne Institute, if you look at that data, people who, the 70% of people who didn't receive a pay rise are going backwards at 3.5% per year. So it just illustrates just how uneven the recovery is, and how, just it's not very, let's just put it this way, it's not very good. It's quite poor. You know, I mean, Australian households are going backwards at the most rapid rate, excluding the initial pandemic shock, since inflation was 6% back in the year 2000.
And it's worth remembering that for many people, they've had no real wage increase in the last decade. So it's not like this has suddenly happened, right? This grind down has been going on for at least the last 10 years. And the problem is that the aggregated data, which you quite rightly say, includes those sectors where they've actually had done really, really well. So, for example, investment bankers have had a wonderful year, right? Why? Because of all the transactions and all the, you know, the everything else, because of all the volume of trade that was going through the system over the last 12 to 18 months, they've done really well. Whereas if you look at some other sectors of the economy, and I'm thinking of some of the healthcare workers in the public sector, they've almost got, you know, no growth. And of course, the other thing about this most recent statistics, there is still the hangover from the last low wage pay agreement that was put in place, which was a sort of a series of drops over a period of time. So even that's artificial. So the true situation for many households, I see it in my surveys, is they've had no forward progression in real terms at all for a decade, whilst cost of living are continuing to rise well above the stated CPI, and no prospect of that changing. And I think the conversation about, well, people are switching from one job to another, may be happening in specific sectors, IT, for example, but it's certainly not happening in many others. So I'm afraid that this whole story is one of, you know, long, slow grind to nowhere.
Yeah, it's a rather sad state of affairs, unfortunately. And I think that, just, you know, looking at things more broadly, it speaks to a sick economy. You know, we have had closed borders for 2 years. We've had reversing net migration for 2 years. We've had the largest stimulus in Australian history by a factor of almost 10.
Yes.
In the last 2 years. Yet in that time, we haven't managed to engineer anything approaching reasonable wages growth, given the inflationary circumstances.
No.
Now, if we can't achieve that under the most arguably ideal of conditions, with the highest degree of support, you know, on all counts, how are we going to be able to do it next year, or the year after that, or 5 years from now? You know, it speaks to an economy that has some fairly major structural issues that are frankly being, I'm not going to say entirely ignored, but mostly ignored. And one of them, and the elephant in the room, is household debt. You know, well, there's household debt, and there's also high immigration. The idea that if you wait long enough, at least this is the current setting, if you wait long enough, the borders will open up and you can hire someone cheaper from overseas.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've made a couple of shows this week on that thing because, you know, one, the argument that you bring migration in, and of course it sucks up all of that spare property that we've got floating around the place, all those high rise that nobody wants to buy at the moment, but it does have a depressive effect on wages. In fact, Phil Lowe some months ago made that point, that actually wages growth was stronger because of the lack of migration. The other point, though, of course, in all of this, is that we know that with the interest rate environment going to rise, we're going to find a lot of employers under financial pressure to try and make their businesses work. And so one of the variable costs they've got is actually keeping wages under control, right? Because it's, so there's a bit of a substitution. And the longer that this goes on, the less productive the economy comes. And I keep coming back to, we should be talking much more about productivity per capita rather than just overall GDP, right? Because productivity has gone back. And if you actually compare productivity and migration. There is no evidence at all that increased migration has led to greater productivity. In fact, the reverse is true. And that's because of the structural mix of jobs and the fact that a lot of people are being paid much lower than previously to do, frankly, jobs that, well, they're not, you know, we probably need them, but they're not actually very well paid, or they're not very productive jobs. So we've got some really deep structural issues here. And yet, you know, if you listen to the politicians, they'll claim that the economy is wonderfully managed and, you know, we've got a plan for the future. Well, I have to say, I don't think that a plan exists, or if it does, it's just taking the sticker off the last 10 years and just replaying it again, hoping for a different outcome, which won't happen.
No, and eventually, you know, you will reach a point where it won't work anymore. You know, and that is arguably where we're at to a degree already. You know, we've seen these, you know, fantastic conditions that, I mean, if you had have asked an economist in 2005, what would things look like if Australia went to zero net migration and threw all this money at the economy, they would tell you that unemployment would go to like 3% and wages would probably go to 6 or 7, you know.
Almost zero interest rates.
Yeah, and zero interest rates. I'd be like, duh, of course, you know, the economy is going to go through the roof. And here we are with deeply negative real wage growth.
Yep.
And it's really quite abysmal, to be completely frank. And I just think it's a bit of a joke, because you just know that whatever party is in power is going to crow about the headline GDP number while leaving things like, you know, measures like productivity or real household disposable income per capita and other, you know, shall we say, more fringe indicators like that really are the true measure of success for, you know, in individual households. You know, they're left to just, you know, Senate estimates, random reports that most people will never read. You know, I'm sure that there are some of our viewers who will, you know, and I know you and I will, but for the most part, most people, all they hear about is, are we in a recession? Are we not? How strong is headline GDP?
Yeah, and I have to say that a lot of the mainstream reporting of the GDP number only picks the top line, doesn't actually go into any of the detail, doesn't actually point out how misleading the top line GDP number is. And as we've discussed previously, of course, GDP measures throughput, whatever the throughput is. It might be productive, it might be unproductive, it might be polluting, it might be not polluting, it might be criminal, it might not be criminal. The whole GDP philosophy is, frankly, well, it should be thrown out completely, in my view.
Well, you know, I mean, that's something that you and I have both talked about at length. And I mean, all I can say is that I agree. Okay, now this is a good chart from Christopher Joy that shows that capital city housing prices have experienced the fifth biggest boom year in Australian history, bigger than the Melbourne land boom, bigger than the booms of the 2000s, bigger than any boom before. And here we are, you know, we've managed to completely screw over anyone who doesn't own a property, and even those who do. Well, you better hope that you've got a couple, because if you're going to transact ever again, you're going to have to pay the stamp duty, and you know it just makes things all the more challenging. But you know, here we are.
Yeah, and interestingly, a lot of people in my surveys who've got this equity now because prices went up last year, right? They're really seriously thinking about, well, maybe I should get out quick and release some of that equity, because you know people are now talking about house prices dropping. Westpac's come out this week and said, well, you know, 2022-23, we'll see falls. We're going to see a very interesting dynamic where we're going to see more people who are sitting on this paper profit, hoping to realise it. But then, as you say, what do they do next? Do they buy something else? Do they not? Do they go renting or whatever? So we've really messed up the economy here. We've messed it up to the point where, you know, this housing thing, this monster, has taken over the the keys of the economy. And everybody's just saying, well, we better give it a bit more food here and, you know, a bit more support there, because it's too big now. It's rampaging around the place and we can't control it. If only we could actually get some politicians who would really take this seriously and start to actually think about the future. Because you've got to ask the question, Tarek, how does this play out? You know, when does property become too expensive, right? To the point where nothing else happens. Well, we're getting close to it, but we're not quite there yet. So I don't know. It just seems this is, you know, this chart just really is a killer, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, it came with a warning from Christopher Joy that he, that in his view, property prices could fall 15 to 25% on the first 100 basis points of the RBA's hiking cycle. And I think that's really quite interesting, because, you know, as much as some people dislike the guy, he has been correct. And, you know, you can debate as to why, but, you know, that does, you know, raise some rather interesting questions, because, you know, let's say that the market is correct about the direction of rates. Personally, I think it's wrong. Personally, I think that the global economy is going to run in a puff, whether it's as a result of inflation or whether it's just as a result of stimulus fading. And I don't think we are going to see to that, you know, these sort of terminal, you know, these terminal rates north of 2% here in Australia. But let's say I'm wrong. The market is pricing in a 2.5% cash rate by the end of 2023. What would that do to housing prices? That is a pretty big question for any property investor and for anyone who is relying on the value of their property remaining the same because they want to move, or, you know, whatever reason they may have.
Well, there's that old Peter Tulip model when he was working at the RBA, which showed that 100 basis points in the medium term would translate to a 30% movement in house prices, right? And of course, he was going the other way. So if you cut the rate by 100 basis points, expect a 30% rise. The reverse is also true, right? So if you get a 100% basis point rise, you're going to see a 30% drop. That's in their modelling. Now, the modelling's not very good, but it's actually a very important leading indicator of what we see. And again, I see precisely the same, that in fact, if in prices, you know, are prices are very sensitive to debt, debt is very sensitive to rates. If rates move, that changes the debt. We're already seeing debt coming off the top in terms of the growth of new loans. That leads then to a supply-demand disequilibrium in the property market. More people try to sell. As they try to sell, some people are forced to sell as well. That puts downward pressure on prices, and so you get the negative spiral. And, you know, I've been through that, I think, four times now in various places around the world where I've lived. So I know that happens, right? In Australia, we seem to have largely avoided it so far. But at some point, it'll happen.
Well, you know, it's one of those things, isn't it? You know, it's sort of as sure as, you know, as the sun will rise, because, you know, it's just the reality of things. You know, I mean, if we had, you know, rocketing wages growth, you know, and lower inflation, then maybe we could have a conversation about a greater equilibrium being reached. But that isn't happening. In fact, we've seen the fifth largest housing price boom in Australian history at a time when real wages have been going backwards the entire time.
Yep.
Now, I think that's an enormous policy mistake, and I don't know how anyone can look at it and go, yes, that was a good idea.
No, well, that's right. And interestingly, of course, in New Zealand, the latest monetary policy statement out there has actually now come down, and they're basically forecasting a more significant drop in house prices because rates are going up quicker. So again, over in New Zealand, they've actually got that same relationship. So they're now forecasting a significant fall in prices too. Wherever you look, we have problems.
We do. I mean, what was the prediction from the RBNZ? They were talking about a terminal rate of, what was it, 3.25% now?
Yeah, that's about right. Yep.
Well, there you go. That's gonna create a lot of fun and games for the New Zealand property market.
Yeah, but they are talking about higher migration. That'll save them.
Well, that's gonna be an interesting one, isn't it? You know, the battle royale between rising migration and 3.25% interest rates.
Absolutely.
My money's on interest rates, but you know, it's gonna be a hell of a sight to see.
It certainly will be very interesting. And of course, then what happens is that people migrate to New Zealand while New Zealanders migrate to Australia, and the music continues.
Yeah, and it, you know, and the big winner is the property market, as always.
Absolutely, yes, always. Although ProBuild would suggest that it's not always a winner, right?
Well, no, that's a whole nother question, isn't it? I mean, in a way, perhaps not with ProBuild itself, but with the building sector in general, it does speak to an interesting issue, because part of the problem here in Australia is that the when it comes to the cost components of housing, land is such a huge, huge component. You know, it used to be, you know, there was a time, you know, long, long ago when it used to be like 25-30% of the cost. Most of the thing was getting the materials and building the actual house. Now it's completely flipped the other way. And, you know, you drive around parts of Sydney, parts of Melbourne, particularly in, you know, not even in especially affluent areas. You know, you see a decent sized block. Some of them are, you know, $2 million. $2 million for an empty block in suburban Sydney. You know, I mean, okay, the house is probably going to cost $500,000 or $600,000 for something, you know, really super tasty. But you're talking about the land component being so, so expensive. And you just imagine how much more vibrant our construction industry could be, and how much, you know, we could have nicer houses, for example, instead of cracking with mansions or dog boxes that are flammable, you know. But, you know, that's just the nature of the game, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, we've touched on it before, Tarek, and I'm sure we'll touch on it again, but the whole property scenario is not looking very good. Now, have you got more slides, or are we there?
I believe this is the last one.
And what a way to end.
Yes. Well, as Alex Joyner from IFM said on Twitter, I think it was about a week and a half ago now, people better hope that that the economists are right and that the market is wrong. I mean, even if the economists are right, they've still got a pretty concerning time ahead, with rates potentially heading up towards 1.5%. But if the market is right and we are going to see rates north of 1.5%, you know, this year, then, you know, we've got some fairly major issues here in Australia. I mean, I honestly think, look at this, and I, you know, I mean, I can't help but have a little bit of a chuckle, to be completely honest with you, mostly because I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, look, it's possible that external factors could continue to prop up inflation, particularly with geopolitical problems. You know, that could, you know, if we do see the tit for tat escalation between Russia and the US and the West more broadly, as I mentioned earlier, if that does really kick off, then yeah, sure. You know, we could see a 2.5% cash rate. It's very possible, but base case, I think that's gonna kill the economy before we get there.
And just for those who are colorblind like myself, of the two dotted lines, the one at the top, is that the economist or the market expectation?
That's the market.
Yeah. Okay. So the market has a much higher expectation, which is what we've spoken about before. The economists basically are saying there'll be a range, and it's quite a wide range. And the cash rate at the moment is sitting right down the bottom. So yeah, it certainly shows the potential. Remember, of course, that median expectation is of the cash rate, not the mortgage rate. So if you've got a mortgage, you need to add on what, another couple of percent on top of it.
Yeah, but I mean, what is the bank's net interest margin these days? What, 1.8, 1.92%?
Yeah, about 2% plus or minus. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So, folks, think about your mortgage at 4.5%.
Yeah, I think that's it. That's just, you know, sort of pretty reasonable thing. I mean, the RBA's median, or I believe, I'm not sure if it's median or average, but the RBA's average rate that they record as being paid on variable rate mortgages is about 3.05%.
Yep.
So realistically, you're going to be talking about an average around about 5.5.
Yep.
And that's a pretty far cry.
And of course, from a low base, that move up, in terms of cash terms, in terms of the extra you have to pay each month, is huge, which is why I've been running some sensitivities on what happens when rates go up. And in fact, there'll be some of those featured in some of the newspapers over the next few days. We did Adelaide this week. We're going to do, I think, Brisbane next week. It's quite scary how many people get sucked into that category of stressed. And interestingly, a lot of them are actually more affluent households who are highly leveraged with bigger mortgages and bigger loans, because they're not used to this significant uptick which is coming. So I'm afraid that the story of pain is not just going to be concentrated in the outer suburbs. We're going to see it in core market areas and high affluent areas too.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point, just regarding, you know, the relativity of the thing. For example, back when rates rose in the 2000s, you know, towards the GFC, you know, that rate rise in terms of the percentage of in terms of the proportion of the cash rate that rose, is significantly lower than the rate rises that we're going to see potentially if the market is correct. You know, if you're talking about a 3% RBA average thereabouts, and you have a 2.5% rise, you know, we haven't seen those kinds of rises since, well, frankly, in this shorter period, I don't think we've ever seen rates rise that quickly proportionally. They have risen by that much, you know, nominally. But I think that's something that could be really quite concerning if the market is right and, you know, I'm wrong.
Well, expect to see three things if that happens. The first is the RBA will provide TFF version 2 to the banks, right, at a very low rate or maybe even a negative rate. Secondly, the banks will roll out more of those programs like they did for COVID. In other words, you know, extending the life of the loan or moving on to interest only for a period, because the last thing the banks want to do is to start dealing with people actually falling into default. And the third thing that they will do is they will actually tighten up the lending standards for new loans. But of course, most people already got a loan, so it's irrelevant. So that's going to be the playbook. And it'll be very interesting to see how successful that playbook is in the environment of rates at 3, 4, 5%, because I think the outcome could be quite different.
Yeah, indeed. It's just, it's going to be quite different. And I think that there's even just the psychological factor is going to be significant. You know, I mean, there are people more, you know, almost 60% of the way through a 20-year mortgage who have never seen rates rise in the entire time that they've held their loan. You know, it's completely flipped the psychology of the market. Like it used to be, you know, between like the, say, I think it was about 1967, 1968, when Vietnam really started to kick off and US inflation picked up, you saw rates roughly triple between then and the late 1980s, the early 1990s. And it just makes you think, because what it's like, well, what happens, you know, what happens now when we've seen the psychology go from, you know, we started out with, I'm afraid of rate rises, I need to be careful. Then we went into, no, it's fine, rates are never going to rise again, it's all right, Phil told me 2024, to once again back into that, you know, that, what I mean, that concern, perhaps even fear level. And I think that's going to be something that's going to be potentially quite significant amongst boomer property investors, because that is something that they have seen play out before. And because, I mean, you know, people my age, I mean, we haven't seen, you know, rates rise. Most people in Australia have not seen rates rise significantly in their adult lives.
Yep.
So, you know, to see this kind of rate pressure, you know, I think we could really see a few spooked boomers. I mean, you know, at least the ones I've spoken to, they're quite concerned about rising rates.
Yes, and of course, that concern then leads to decisions to spend less, to hunker down, to be more cautious. And that can be actually part of a self-reinforcing cycle of negativity, which means that you then get less economic activity and momentum and all those things follow. So I think it's going to be really, really interesting. And look, we've pretty much come to the end of our time tag. I was hoping to talk to you today about some of the political posturing around some of this, but we'll have to do another show on that, because I think I've been absolutely astonished by some of the things that I've heard in recent times of people throwing, you know, all sorts of things out there trying to make particular points. But economically speaking, I think both you and I will conclude there are a certain amount of uncertainty out there at the moment.
Most certainly. And I will add, for anyone who wants a better look at these charts, I've sent Martin the link and it will be in the description.
Terrific. Yeah, and it's great that you've got those available as well, because people do ask for them afterwards. So, Tarek, thanks once again. As always, a very important conversation, I think, this week, and some very important points made. So thanks for your time, and we'll do it again soon.
Yeah, definitely. Hopefully there won't be too much has transpired until the next time we speak.
Well, who knows? Every time we say that, but then every time we say, oh, more things are happening. So we'll see. Thanks, Tarek. See you.
No worries, mate. You're welcome.